Matt Gollenbeck and 20 Years on Mars, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. We just celebrated the 20th anniversary of the Pathfinder lander's arrival on the Red Planet. We're also celebrating the continuous presence of humanity's robots on and above Mars ever since. And I can't think of anyone better to celebrate with than JPL's Matt Gollenbeck, who has been deeply involved in nearly every American mission to Mars over those two decades. Matt will join us in a few minutes. Bill Nye has the week off as he sets out on tour with his brand new book, Everything All at Once. But we've got Bruce Betts to tell us about the night sky and offer some great prizes in the new space trivia contest. We begin by spending a few minutes with the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy, Casey Dreyer. Casey, good to get you back on the regular edition of Planetary Radio. It sounds like the nation once again has a National Space Council, sort of.
Yes, we do. The executive order has been signed. That means we have a, at least on paper, a group of individuals, heads of various government agencies that all involve space, an as yet undefined user advisory group of outside experts, probably industry representing space interests, and led by Mike Pence, the Vice President of the United States, as yet to meet to form some sort of coherent space policy for both military and civilian space in the United States. That is the intention. We haven't had one since the early George H.W. Bush administration back in the late 80s, so it's a step. It's something.
And Pence had some pretty flowery things to say when he spoke at Kennedy Space Center the other day.
He certainly did, and he even touched a piece of space hardware that said don't touch, but don't worry, NASA said it was okay. But, yeah. You know, he came, and, you know, if I kind of was thinking that I were vice president, I would totally go to all of the NASA centers and give cool speeches and see space hardware. That would be a good perk of the job.
I wouldn't have stopped at touching Orion. I'd have climbed inside.
Right. They may have tackled you before you got into that one. But the it's interesting. I mean, he went down to Kennedy Space Center. He gave a nice speech, and that really shows, you know, he didn't have to do that. Even as the head of the National Space Council, the vice president is always kind of nominally the head of that since back in Nixon and even before days. I think it does show that he has genuine interest in space exploration, and we should appreciate that and be thankful for that, because that will make our job in promoting space science and exploration a lot easier here in the next 4 to 8 years.
Long ways to go, though. I mean, there are some pretty key members of this group that are still missing.
Notably, the NASA administrator does not exist, has not been nominated, nor confirmed, obviously. And the director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy within the White House has yet to be even nominated. Those are two key positions that we are waiting for. And even, again, if they were nominated, let's say, tomorrow, as we record this, the U.S. Senate, which confirms these positions, is only in service for about another 2.5 weeks before they take a long summer break, the August recess, for about 6 weeks. And then they come back to some pretty heavy political stuff. And we're not even talking about healthcare. We're talking about the budget, debt ceilings, debt limits, and all this other kind of tax stuff. Maybe, who knows? There is going to be a very packed schedule, and we may not see an NASA administrator in the office for maybe even towards the end of the year.
Wow. And it's already a record. We do talk about the National Space Council on the latest edition of the Space Policy Edition. Casey, thanks. I hope people will check out that new extended Space Policy Edition at planetary.org.
Thank you, Matt.
That's Casey Dreyer. He's the Director of Space Policy for the Planetary Society. He and his colleagues doing good work on behalf of those of us who care about the final frontier in Washington, D.C., where all the big decisions are made. We're going to go on now to talking to a guy who has been a Martian for over 20 years, Matt Gollenbeck, about the 20th anniversary of the landing of Pathfinder on the Red Planet. Matt Gollenbeck was the project scientist for Pathfinder, the Mars lander that brought us back to the Martian surface in 1997. As you'll hear from Matt, this marked the end of a decades-long drought. It also reminded all of us just how exciting a Mars mission is, especially one that included a cute little rover called Sojourner. Pathfinder was more a proof of concept than a science mission, but it still did great science, and it did blaze a path for the twin Mars exploration rovers and many other efforts. Matt is now the project scientist for Opportunity, the rover that recently completed a stunning 13 Earth years of activity on Mars. But there are many other missions that benefit from Matt's vast experience on the Red Planet, and he has also played a key role in determining landing sites. He happily accepted my invitation for a return to Planetary Radio and talked to me via Skype from his office at the Jet Propulsion Lab. Matt Gollenbeck, welcome back to Planetary Radio, and congratulations on helping to be a part of not just the beginning, but throughout 20 years of a continuous human presence at Mars. That is quite an accomplishment.
I'm amazed it's happened. It's certainly a pleasure to be back, of course. I often talk of myself as being one of the oldest Martians. So a Martian, I'll define as someone who has done nothing but Mars, and I've been doing that now since Pathfinder development, and that was the first Mars mission in the modern era, and I've been doing that continuously. Well, that's 23, 24 years now.
Without regret, I think, right? Do you ever, look up at Jupiter and think, how come I'm not studying gas giants?
No. Mars is way too cool. Not even close. Europa, being a geologist, Europa's kind of cool, but no, Mars is it.
You're a geologist, so it's nice to go where there are rocks and not just gas. Take us back 20 years to the landing of that spacecraft and rover on top of it, because we got to talk about Sojourner as well, and what that marked in terms of essentially a return to Mars.
Yeah, and I think it's actually, I want to take you back to 25 years before, which is a hiatus of almost 20 years in our exploration of Mars. And the failure of Mars Observer, which had happened not that long before. That was supposed to be our return to Mars. And in the Mars science community, I would say a lot of our interpretations were getting pretty stale because there was no new information. A lot of us who were in the planetary program just felt we needed some way to get back to Mars to revitalize our thought processes about what were going on. All of the analysis was based on 20-year-old Viking data, and people have been picking over that for a really long time. We had to get back there somehow.
and we did in style. I mean, it was during that era of better, faster, cheaper, right?
Yeah, that's right. Pathfinder was the first or second discovery mission. It was better, faster, cheaper. It was done for less than the movie you didn't see called Waterworld.
Did it mark this turnaround in our exploration of Mars and, more importantly, our understanding of Mars?
Yeah, I think in both cases, the answer to that's yes. How could you have a MIR if you didn't have a Sojourner? How could you have a Curiosity if you didn't have a MIR? And we certainly wouldn't be thinking of a Mars 2020 rover if you didn't have a Curiosity. And so there's a direct lineage from the Pathfinder rover. It was just smaller, but it's basically the same rocker bogey design. There's not really all that much different. But the way in which we operate a rover on the surface is fundamentally different from the way you operate an orbiter. Or even in some ways a fixed lander, because with a fixed lander, you're in the same place all the time.
Yeah.
Rover, each day that you move, you have to make a decision that's based on what happened the previous sol. And that set up a whole new way of organizing the science team into these science theme groups that would have input. The whole rover can only go in one direction at a time. You can't have the camera guys looking in one direction and the sample guys. Like, everybody's got to be together and organized. And all of that organization of the science team, the way we operated, the main functioning of how we collected data and put it into sample cache, a lot of the hardware, the operating systems on the central computers, all of that was laid out and begun by Pathfinder. So I would say, without Pathfinder, as a Pathfinder, it's not clear we would have a Mars exploration program. And that's just talking about it from a technical and scientific standpoint. I think if you add in the fact that this was, in my view, without question, the most popular Mars mission ever. I mean, at that time, this is before the internet was really going, we had front page headlines on every newspaper in America for a week. A week. There is no other Mars mission that's had it for more than a day or two. And this was continuous. The whole world was watching us. And we had one day we had trouble with the rover being communicated with the, and everyone was interested in what was going to happen. It was, you know, did the rover get off today? What did it do? Did, oh my God, is it getting lost? Is it? And it brought a whole generation to the surface exploration of a planet in a way that's fundamentally different from a flyby or an orbiter. That excitement, that's what gave us a Mars program.
I remember this so well. And the feeling, particularly from Sojourner, that little rover, it was so charming. It was this little pet that was exploring Mars for us.
Yeah, absolutely. And each day you'd look at it, where'd the rover go? What is it doing today? Absolutely.
How did you feel when Sojourner was resurrected for the film The Martian?
lots of fun, lots of fun.
I thought maybe I know JPL helped the filmmakers, right? To get it right.
Yeah, that's right.
That, as you say, was the beginning that you built on to go to the Mars exploration rovers. Opportunity, of course, still very much exploring the surface of Mars. But to stick with Pathfinder for another moment or two, even the MIR spacecraft, even the MIR rovers, we don't want to forget Spirit, though it is now resting in peace, we hope, had the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter looking down from above. You didn't have that with Pathfinder, did you?
Yeah, that's the main difference, is that we had no new information outside of what Viking had collected 20 years before. So if you think about it, you know, I do landing sites as well. We selected a landing site based on Viking images from 20 years before. And the average resolution on Mars from Viking was about 200 meters per pixel.
Wow.
And the engineers are worried about rocks the size of your desk.
JPL senior research scientist and certified Martian, Matt Golombek, will be back with much more after the break. My complete conversation with Matt is in the podcast at planetary.org/radio. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Hi, I'm Kalisa with the Planetary Society. We've joined with the U.S. National Park Service to make sure everyone is ready for the 2017 North American Total Solar Eclipse. Together, we've created the new Junior Ranger Eclipse Explorer Activity Book. It helps kids learn about the science, history, and fun of eclipses. Call your nearest national park and ask if they have the Eclipse Explorer book, or you can download it from nps.gov/kids or at planetary.org/eclipse.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. I seriously doubt that there is a scientist who has furthered our exploration of Mars more than JPL's Matt Golombek. Name the mission, and he has probably had a hand in it and helped lead the process of choosing its landing site, if it was a lander or a rover. I asked Matt for his take on the most important things we've learned about Mars in the 20 years since Pathfinder arrived there.
From the Viking data, there were hints of valley networks in the ancient Noachian terrain on Mars to suggest that the early environment on Mars may have been wetter. We didn't know how much warmer and how much wetter or how continuous it was. And I would say it was a hint. It wasn't fully accepted that it was wetter. But now, with all of the information we've gotten in the past 20 years, including examples from the surface and from orbit, we have, I would say, unassailable information that rocks were processed into water-bearing minerals on the surface of Mars, that occurred for significant periods of times in which water was at least moderately stable on the surface. And thus the suggestion that the very early history at Mars, at about the same time when life got started here on the Earth, that Mars might have been similar. So if water is the common, liquid water is the common denominator for life as we know it here on Earth, did Mars have a second genesis? Could life have formed anywhere that liquid water was stable, or are we an accident of the highest order? And that's the kind of question that we can ask from a Mars exploration program in a scientific manner.
Yeah.
I'd say that's about as compelling as you can get.
Let's jump forward to, a few years, and really to the present, because, of course, you are the Mars Exploration Rover Project scientist. Opportunity, as we said, continues to explore the surface, building on what came before. What is Opportunity after now, and what would you say is the legacy of Spirit and Opportunity?
The legacy, I think, is the beginning of having Opportunity land at a location in which we saw clear evidence for evaporites, sulfate evaporites, that occurred in standing water at the surface of Mars in the late Noachian, early Hesperian. I don't see any other geologic model that fits that observation. The fact that Spirit saw water processed rocked in the Noachian highlands of the Columbia Hills, those are undeniable cases of groundwater and even surface water being involved in the genesis of those materials on Mars. Undeniable, in my view. Opportunity has since explored the rim of a Noachian crater and found clay minerals that form in neutral pH conditions, kind of like water that you could drink here now. Unlike the earlier sulfates, which were dominantly acid-rich waters, almost so acid it's more acid than your car battery, there are things that live in that kind of solutions, but there are not a lot of them. And we usually think of the earlier neutral pH waters as being more conducive to the genesis of life. So I think we have clear evidence that water was common early on Mars. And in the earlier period, it was a kind of water that is just fine for life. And so the next question is, you know, were all the things you needed to form life there? Those are kinds of questions that Mars Science Laboratory Curiosity is beginning to take a crack at. And certainly that Mars 2020 is going to have a major stab at with the return of the samples, eventually we hope, but also the analytic instruments on board.
Sort of personal question. If you were the NASA administrator and were handed a lot of money for another mission to Mars, let's assume that there is another orbiter, an MRO replacement with communications technology and a big telescope like HiRISE. What mission would you most like to see going to Mars next as a follow-on to what's already happened?
In a sense, the Mars science community has made a statement that the return of carefully collected suite of samples from the surface of Mars would provide the biggest advance in our knowledge, and I don't disagree with that. The difficulty is getting those samples back from Mars, and how many additional missions and the cost of those missions to do it. So the Mars 2020 rover will collect and cache those samples. You now need a mission to go and get those samples and put them into a sample return canister and launch them from the surface of Mars, presumably into orbit, the current kind of scenarios. And then you need another mission that would go and collect that sample canister from Mars and bring it back to the Earth. And then you need a sample collection facility on Earth that rivals the Center of Disease Control contamination facility that would cost equally as much as any of those missions to ensure that those materials were kept separate from the Earth. So those are all big ticket items, and how you then begin those steps towards returning those samples are really the difficult part of our planning exercises.
Sample return. I guess if it was easy, everybody would have already done it.
Yeah, and we would have done it a bunch of times, too.
I hope that that is still in our future as we continue to explore the Red Planet. Thank you for your long career on that world and on this one. And I hope there are many more successes ahead, and that we can talk to you again as we continue the exploration.
I look forward to it.
Matt Gollenbeck, we've been talking with him in his office at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where he has been for so many years. Currently is the MER Project Scientist, that's Mars Exploration Rover Project Scientist. Previously, of course, as the Pathfinder Project Scientist, but with many other jobs and research efforts underway, he continues to be one of the leaders of our efforts to choose a landing site on Mars for the next rover that we'll visit there, the 2020 rover, which still doesn't have a nicer name. I hope there'll be a nice contest for that.
I'm sure there will.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. And he's back with more about the night sky and other good stuff, and another Planetary Radio t-shirt to give away. The new design, which one of my brothers now has. I still don't have one.
It's really hard to feel sorry for you. I don't know how this happened, but we do like your brothers better than we like you, so that could have something to do with it.
Everybody does. It's just not fair. And he became a member and was able to pick up a shirt, but I'm still looking forward to getting mine. Anyway, you don't have one yet, do you? Better not.
No, but I'm not complaining, am I?
No more complaints. Tell me about the sky.
Well, get up earlier, stay up late, because Venus is just looking lovely in the eastern sky in the pre-dawn, and it's hanging out for the next week or so. It's actually moving past Aldebaran, the bright star in Taurus. So that's something to look for. And on the morning of the 20th of July, the crescent moon will be hanging out near Venus, looking quite lovely. And of course, in the evening sky, we still got Jupiter bright in the west in the early evening and Saturn up in the south in the early evening. And both of them, later in the evening. I was so excited about Venus and Aldebaran and the moon, I just kind of petered out.
And t-shirts.
T-shirts. All right, we move on to this week in space history. 1965, Mariner 4 did the first successful flyby of Mars. 50 years later, to the week anyway, New Horizons in 2015 this week flew past Pluto.
And they look remarkably the same. No, not true.
They're both reddish.
Yeah, that's true.
They both have varied terrains. You can make analogies, but they're made of very different stuff on the surface.
Yeah, great milestones. Are you taking requests for random space fact impressions?
Yes, as long as people are okay with how terrible my impressions are.
Here is a request from Gabriel Thelen in Australia, one of our Down Under fans. There are a lot of them. He says, has Bruce done an Emperor Palpatine random space fact impression? Are you
up to
it?
I can guarantee I have not. I can try. What's the worst that I do? I butcher, the evil dude. So I suppose that's okay.
Go for it.
All right.
Young fool, only now, at the end, do you understand the power of random space fact.
Well done. Well done. I can feel the star system slipping through my fingers as you speak.
Okay. Channeling the power of the dark side. Goodness knows I've got plenty of it.
There you go, Gabriel.
So I'll just give you the fact. This I find fascinating. Pluto's minimum distance from Uranus at 11 AU, 11 astronomical units, is actually less than its minimum distance that it ever has to Neptune, at over 17 AU. That's because Pluto is in a 2-3 orbital resonance with Neptune. In other words, Pluto orbits twice for every three orbits of Neptune. One of the implications is that the objects never come that close to each other.
That is a truly great random space fact.
I'll file it under truly great ones.
Yeah, me too. All right, on to the contest.
All right, I asked you, in what year was the supernova observed that formed the Crab Nebula, which you can still see even in relatively small telescopes now? How'd we do?
What I loved about this one is how many people said they didn't need to look it up. What an audience.
Awesome.
Jeff Belbach, I think a first-time entry, said that the supernova that would form, eventually, the Crab Nebula, was recorded by Chinese astronomers in, drumroll please, 1054. 1054, is that right?
That is correct.
Jeff, congrats. Nice work on your first outing. And if it's not, nice work anyway. You are going to receive that brand new Chop Shop Design Planetary Radio t-shirt along with the 200-point itelescope.net astronomy account to do astronomy from home, but using telescopes all over the world on that network that belongs to iTelescope. So have fun doing that. A different Gabriel, actually, Gabe Eggers in Atlanta, Georgia. He said, fun fact, the Chinese called supernovae guest stars due to their bright and temporary nature.
And this evening's guest star will form the Crab Nebula.
You stand back, please. Ilya Schwartz, we hear from him a lot in Columbia, Maryland. It was observed later by English astronomer John Bevis in 1731. The nebula was the first astronomical object identified with a historical supernova explosion, he says. There's also some evidence, according to Ilya, that it was seen in the Middle East, in Baghdad. There was a report made, actually it was a copy of a report that didn't appear until the 13th century, but apparently it was observed back in 1054 from there as well.
All right, here's your trivia question for next time. What other kind of ice forms what appeared to be snow-capped peaks on the top of water ice mountains on Pluto? What's the ice that was found to be forming the, covering the some of the peaks of the water ice mountains on Pluto? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Good one. You got until Wednesday, July 19 at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer. Win yourself a Planetary Radio t-shirt, the new design from Chop Shop, the Planetary Society Chop Shop store. You can check that out online. 200pointitelescope.net account, and your very own set of Bill Nye and Planetary Society eclipse glasses. They're the cardboard kind, but they have the certified plastic that you can look through safely when the eclipse comes on August 21st, the Great American Eclipse.
Excellent. Go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what you would do with force lightning. You know, that stuff that shoots out of the Emperor's hands? What would you do with it? Thank you. Good night.
I'd make toast. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its members, who are pretty much all Martians. Danielle Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.